Not dead yet. It's true, and we all think it's funny. It's good to remember. Hey, darling, thank you. Then we stay alert. And think, I must not waste time. Every moment counts. And that brings incredible enthusiasm. So we're going to listen to these teachings, think about the meaning, see if there's some tools we can take from it to help us develop our amazing potential so we can be of benefit to suffering sentient beings. So do you have any questions from your discussions or from your thinking since during lunchtime? Any questions? Anything at all? Yeah. Two questions, okay. Microphone. Okay.
My name is...
Is on? There we go. Who are you?
My name is Giuseppe.
Giuseppe, happy to meet you. Thank you, Giuseppe.
I'd like to talk about the motivation we've been talking before, the motivation in relation to the karma.
Yes.
And specifically, I'd like to talk about the positive karma, okay?
Yes. I understand, yes, exactly.
The very first person that comes to my mind is Mother Teresa.
Yes, exactly, yes.
And I was thinking about the fact that whilst she did such an enormous quantity of beautiful things towards people compassionately, beneficial for everyone. So many poor people. Okay.
That's right.
But she started from a motivation, from a foundation, thought foundation of a different tradition.
But it was compassion, wasn't it?
Yes.
Isn't that the bottom line? So what's the question?
She believed in the soul, which was Catholic.
Sure, yeah.
Okay. What does it entail from the viewpoint of karma to do some really positive things? In terms of compassion, but not being actually, not having, taken actually vows, or not believing actually in Buddhism.
Well, she, if we think of, I understand. Put it the other way around. What Buddha is saying is that ethics and virtue, ethics is what is that ethical behavior is what. That actions done on the basis of virtuous thoughts is what brings good results. Well, then if Mother Teresa had compassion, she had renunciation, she had empathy, she had a view of a self-existent soul, but that, you know, she might have had wrong view, but she had virtue, so the results will be happy. She'll get God realm, human realm, or maybe even, who knows, she might get a Pure Land. I don't know, I have no idea how, but it has to be her actions were virtuous. They'll bring happy results. That's what the God realm is. God realm is a happy result. And, of course, if you're a Christian, it will bring a God realm. That's the result. That's the result. Blissful states of bliss that will last a long time. But because she hadn't realized emptiness, then that'll end and she'll be back in the lower realms again. Same for all of us. And she had vows. I mean, they weren't Buddhist vows, but she had the vow not to kill, not to steal. She had vowed no sexual misconduct, no sexual activity at all, so she was cutting samsara, wasn't she? I mean, it's virtue. Is that true, don't you think?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. But, I mean, she won't get out of samsara. No matter how good she was, she won't get out of samsara. Emptiness is the only one that does that, isn't it? That's the point. Over here, someone else. Somewhere, yes. Yep.
Susanna.
Thanks
for the wonderful teachings.
Good.
First of all.
Okay.
And then I would like, if possible, possible for you to explain a bit better the link between compassion and attachment.
Absolutely, we can do that.
I'm not quite sure I understand.
Yeah, exactly. We didn't really begin to talk about it yet.
Yeah, because what comes to my mind is the example of my mother.
Yes.
My mother is very sick.
Yes.
And I think, and I'm so sad that
yes.
I really feel kind of compassion.
Yes,
for her.
You do, yeah.
At the same time, the thinking about her all the time.
Yes.
A lot of time in my mind.
Yes.
And then I think this is
a... I understand. I understand your point. I understand exactly. So we haven't really begun to look into the compassion wing yet, and we will, but this is a really good point right now. So when you're a bodhisattva and you only have compassion, you will think about sentient beings all the time. There is nothing left. That's all you're going to think about. But with us now, because you do have compassion, no problem. But what you know, and the attachment we have, you see, if we can understand, okay, if we can understand that the sort of the main craving of attachment, sometimes it can be specific, you know, you want a cake or you want, you know, lovely music, but the broad view of attachment is to get, attachment wants only the nice things. Think about this. It only wants pleasant things. Attachment can't stand problems. So your mother being sick is a very big problem for your attachment. You see, that attachment is self-centered. Attachment is only for me. So you have compassion, which causes you to go beyond your own needs and to sacrifice yourself and to love your mother and look after her and even to worry about her. But what we don't see is if we have attachment, that's what makes us miserable. We think we suffer because our mother is sick. You would not suffer if you didn't have attachment. You don't suffer literally. Suffering is based on the delusions, on the neuroses. So if there's no attachment, there can't be suffering. You'd be crying, you'd be sad, you'd be thinking of others all the time, you'd never stop helping them. But it's kind of interesting that's not what's called suffering. Suffering is because we have ego grasping, the self-centered I, and because we have attachment. So the way attachment, it drags our compassion down. It limits us. So, you know, with this attachment, wanting only the pleasant experiences. Like I used about the baby. If your baby is always beautiful and your baby only sleeps when you want it and never cries, it's easy to always have love and compassion for your baby. But as soon as your baby stays up all night and, you know, and is crying all the time, our attachment gets very upset. And that's what makes us unhappy. So in your case with your mother, you love your mother. You have compassion for your mother. There's no question. They're virtues. But if we have attachment, if you have attachment, that makes you anxious, that makes you worried. And the other thing it does, it kind of it pollutes the compassion. And it's an attachment also wants to sort of, in English, I don't know, it sticks its nose in where it doesn't belong. Look at a typical mother. She's bossing her child around the whole time. She sticks her nose in their business and she says, oh, it's because I love you. It's because of attachment. Attachment interferes where it doesn't need to. Attachment is always kind of over-exaggerating everything. So attachment is what makes you miserable. Can you see what I'm saying? Compassion is compassion, but when you have no, as we lessen attachment, our compassion gets wiser and stronger and bigger, and we have more courage and we don't suffer. That's kind of so strange to think like this. You can't suffer because of a compassion. You have enormous sadness. I mean, Dalai Lama cries with compassion about suffering of the world, but he's not, you can argue he doesn't suffer. Suffers because of delusions, of neurotic and unhappy and, you know, and anger and fear. That's what causes suffering. Do you see what I'm saying? So, you know, with attachment, I mean, with your mother it's okay, but let's say you had an alcoholic brother, let's say. Then you have such compassion for him. There's no question. He is suffering. You can see his suffering. And you do love him. You want him to be happy. That's virtue. But what we don't see is, his behavior upsets you. He comes home, he vomits in the soup, he makes mum unhappy and dad unhappy. We talk about him behind his back, and then you interfere and tell him to go to AA and do this and do that, and you have all these expectations that he will now stop drinking. It's true you have compassion, but it's mixed with your own attachment because you want to make it all nice. Attachment, it wants to make everything nice. And we think it's virtue, but it's not. If we didn't have attachment, you would have such compassion for him, but it wouldn't drag you down. Do you understand? Attachment is very nervous and worried and interferes with people. It sticks its nose in. It bosses people around. It blames people. It's expectation. That's attachment. Do you understand? But it's because it's so normal, we mix it with the compassion. We think it's the same thing. With compassion, you'd also have, this is the point, the more attachment we have, the less wisdom. The more we see our own projections. You don't see the reality. And also with attachment, because it is exaggerated, even though your brother is sick and he's an alcoholic, that's serious, but it still exaggerates his problem. And you forget all the good qualities that were always there before. Your brother's still got those good qualities, but when you've got attachment and he's not doing what your attachment wants, so you get angry with him, you get upset about him, you get anxious, and that blinds you from seeing properly how to help him. Whereas if you had wisdom more than attachment, you would see that he's not ready for your advice. There's no point in bullying him to go to AA. You will love him for who he is. You will accept him who he is, and you won't be upset. You'll be sad, but you won't be stressed. You have more wisdom when you have less attachment. Do you understand? That's the whole point about all these neuroses. They not just make us unhappy, but they blind us and prevent us from seeing clearly the reality. Do you understand? What else, people? And this is really hard to see. It's so hard to see, you know. It's so subtle. And it's there all the time. This is why people who work in the helping professions, everybody talks about burning out and getting exhausted. This is so strange. You don't get exhausted from helping people. You might, and then you have a good sleep. But you don't get stressed from compassion. It is attachment. Because especially if you're working in a really intense environment, like if you're working in the ER department of the hospital where all the junkies come in and the car accidents, it's so intense. All this really naked suffering, really exhausting. Or you're working with people in prison, or you're working with really intense suffering like, abused children. What we don't notice is because of our attachment not getting what it wants, and then we get angry, we get upset, we get exhausted, that's not from compassion. That's not from working hard. That's from the neuroses. That's from the disturbing emotions. It's very interesting. And because it's so natural for us, we just don't think about it like this. But this is the Buddhist analysis. We need to understand this in our own mind. That's why with the Dalai Lama, for example, the Dalai Lama, such an obvious example. It's such a naked example. If we look at the history of Tibet and the Dalai Lama, he's like the father of all those Tibetans. I mean, he should be having a complete mental breakdown after 60 years of suffering. But we can see the older he gets, the happier he gets, the funnier he gets. He cracks jokes about his enemies, you know. He's not stressed out. We just go, oh, that's the Dalai Lama. No, it's because he's the proof of what we're trying to do. He's got no delusions left, no neuroses, no ego grasping, no attachment, no anger. Okay, he won't admit that. He'll just say he's an ordinary person. But if he is what he is, that's why he's not stressed out. That's why he never gets unhappy. He doesn't get depressed. He doesn't get angry. He never gives up. He's always optimistic, always enthusiastic. That's because he's got mainly virtue and no non-virtue. It's such a powerful example if we could learn and if we could recognize it, you know. He should be, according to the world, he should be out of his brain with misery. Look at the suffering of his country. It never ends, you know. More than a sixth or seventh of the population of Tibet has been destroyed. Every day they come over the border, over the mountains with suffering, you know. He never gives up. He never gives up. And he hasn't stopped. This is the point. For 60 years, isn't it? More than 60, whatever. 119. Yeah, 60 years. Hasn't stopped. Trying. Religious, social, political, diplomatic, every possible method. And he still doesn't give up. He still keeps trying to find ways to fix it. That's what comes from no disturbing emotions. You just never give up. That's the power. That's the power of wisdom and compassion combined, you know. So we have to pace ourselves. We're not like that. We have to recognize what it is that holds us back, what it is that drags us down, why we get upset, why we can't stand being around people. You know, we don't like human beings very well. They make us upset. They make us angry. They make us upset. We don't want to be near them. Bodhisattvas love the crazy sentient beings. They'd much rather live in Rome or New York or Los Angeles among the crazies than live in the mountains with a few trees and be peaceful. That's very depressing to bodhisattvas. The more suffering, the better. Bring it on. We get enthusiasm from it. But of course, we have to recognise where we're at, and we can't handle living in crazy cities because we're not brave enough to handle all the crazy suffering of crazy sentient beings, then you don't go there. You know, you've got to know what you're capable of. We've got to know our own, we've got to recognise our own limitations. We've got to recognise what we're capable of. This is incredibly important. In this whole path, this is incredibly important. We don't think like this. We don't, even though we might have studied this stuff for years, we still don't really experientially see where we're at in terms of all this stuff. You know, if you have a map, you know where you're at. You know where you've come from and you know where you're going. If you're in mathematics classes, you know what level you're at. If you start studying medicine, you know what you're capable of. But when it comes to spiritual, we're very confused and don't know where we're at and don't know what our capability is, you know. And then if we do make choices because we can't handle all the suffering people and we walk away from it, then we get all guilty. I mean, we're just ridiculous. We've got to know what we're capable of, what we can handle. Some people can sacrifice their life for their mother for 50 years and never get upset. Some people can't even cope with more than a week helping their mother. We've got to recognise where we're at, you know, what we can handle. And that because we've got delusions. That's very clear. Because we've got, you know, unhappy states of mind. We've got to recognise where we're at, but don't just give up. Then say, okay, this is my level, but I'll keep working, keep persevering, you know. I mean, you know, use Lama Zopa as an example. All these holy beings don't need sleep. I mean, Dalai Lama looks like he's got a regular schedule, goes to bed at 8 o'clock, gets up at 3 o'clock. He doesn't need sleep if he's a Buddha. It's just he's pretending, you know. But Lama Zopa shows the aspect of not sleeping. I mean, I can't believe, if I think about not sleeping, I get tired. Bed is my favourite thing, isn't it? As you get older, there's nothing else to like. Bed is the best thing in the planet. As you get older, isn't it? Even food's not so exciting. But bed, the thought of going to bed, I'm doing my prayers in the evening. All I can think of is my bed. Waiting for the prayers to finish so I can go to bed. So I can hear it, I can see it. As Roger said years ago, Venerable Roger was quoted as saying that for Lama Zopa, sleep is a disgusting waste of time. So every time I hit the pillow and I try to remember, I say to myself, may I find sleep disgusting. That's the best I can do. I can't even pretend to not sleep. It will be a joke. So I'll happily go to sleep, try and have bodhicitta, and then think, may I find it disgusting, hoping the imprint will be in for next life and I won't want sleep. You know, got to be patient. Isn't it? Anyway, someone else. No other questions? Yes, yes. Microphone, please. See, here. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you. I'm Min.
Who are you? And who are you?
Min.
Min. Okay, Min. Good, Min.
My question is, how can an experience be similar to the cause if the cause is an accident without an intention?
Okay, give an example. Give an example. That's the best way to talk. An example.
What did the mouse do to get this experience because the person doing it to the mouse didn't have the intention and motivation?
Okay, so you've got a mouse in your kitchen. And you stand on the mouse and the mouse dies, but you didn't know. Okay, there's two things, isn't it? One is the karma of the mouse. So clearly the mouse created the cause in the past from killing you. Karma's pretty personal. You could say that. It created the cause to be killed by you. So it got killed. It experienced the results of its own karma. That's for the mouse, experience similar to the cause in the past of having killed. But for you, there was no, you know, you didn't see the mouse. So there's two separate things, the karma you create and the karma of the mouse. So the mouse did nothing now. That's not the point. With experiences similar to the cause for all of us, whether it's all the happy things that happen or all the unhappy things that happen, most of it's not from this life. It's just fruits from past actions, you know. In this life, we're living out every time any good thing happens. See, this is the interesting point about karma. We never think of all the good things. We never think of the good things. But I'm sure for most of us, if we think of our lives, and if you wanted to break down the events of one day, you could count probably thousands more good moments than bad ones, but we don't think like that because we remember the bad things. But what I'm saying is, experiences similar to the cause whether or every time someone's kind to you, every time someone gives you something, every time the food is pleasant, every time the weather's nice, every time all the good things throughout the day that happen, each one of those is an experience for you similar to the cause of some past action of virtue in a past life. Not in this life, rarely in this life. It's all part, most from the time we're conceived, even the time you die, already the karmic seed that will program you to go to your present mother, the karmic seeds that will provide your personality, the karmic seeds that will provide you with your experiences, and the karmic seeds that will provide you with the environmental result, all of that is programmed in the, before you even stop breathing in the past life a few weeks before you found your way to your mother's fallopian tube. So this life we're just acting out past karma, experiencing it. We can adjust it. We can do lots of work now and we can help change it. But all the things that happen to us now are all from past lives. Does that make sense? Okay. Okay. Someone else? Nothing? That's it? See? Back. Go. Kira, you go.
Hi, I'm Kira.
Yes.
And I wanted to ask you, Robina, what about mental illness? I mean,
you mean, okay, I understand. You mean, Kira, so just to be very clear, are you talking about the mental illnesses that are more than what we've got? Because we've all got mental illnesses, remember?
Yeah.
Oh, anger, attachment, jealousy, yeah. Pride. So which ones are you talking about?
Yeah, I'm talking about something which is caused by the brain.
No, it's not caused by the brain. It's not caused by the brain, darling.
I know, but
I know. Listen, Kira, I know I understand your question, but I'm going to be very kind of precise. We're talking Buddhism here. Everything has got the body involved. If you're angry, look at your body. Look at your body. It's shouting. It's yelling. Spit is coming out the mouth. That's physical, baby. But what drives it is anger, the mind. So a person who's got a screwed up brain or funny DNA or wrong genes, that of course it's physical. That is not the main cause of their illness. The main cause of their illness is past negative action of harming sentient beings. That person gets born to a mother who's got a screwed up brain. The brain is the indicator, that's all. It's not the main cause. That's the materialist view of it. But we've got to be very precise in our analysis. The physical can never be the main cause. The physical is not the main cause.
All right.
What do you mean, what happens?
What happens if someone who has a mental illness, which is, you know, Buddhist mental illness, and the Buddhist...
So, is what? Sorry, start again. Is not what?
Someone with a mental illness, which makes...
What's that word you said before that is or isn't Buddhist mental illness? What do you mean? What did you say? Spell it out.
The mental illness that we are agreeing upon, the mental illness...
Which is all the unhappy, all the disturbing states of mind.
Absolutely.
We've all got those.
Absolutely.
So listen, darling, whether you're called psychotic in the world, whether you're a terrorist, whether you're a pedophile, whether you are a torturer, whether you're schizophrenic, whatever labels we use in the West, they're just variations of the mental, of the disturbing emotions and from past karma. That's all. It's the same for all of us. So what's your question?
My question is, what's the responsibility of the person in this lifetime if he or she carries out some actions?
We all carry out actions every day, Kira. I know, listen, honey, I understand your question, but I'm purposely answering in the simple way I'm answering. So you're mentally ill to some degree, so you get a bit lazy, you get a bit attached, you might lie sometimes, you might have cheated on your husband once, I don't know. So you're normal, you're the normal world. But, you know, due to past karma, you have certain tendencies. So your responsibility is you've got to suffer those results whether you know it or not. So the same with a person who's insane or schizophrenic or a pedophile or mad. That's due to their past actions they are this way. That's why we must have compassion for sentient beings, because we're all as blind as bats. None of us think we're responsible. None of us think we're accountable. We will find any reason to get off the hook. Well, it's my mother's fault. It's my this fault. It's my that fault. It's my brain's fault. Everybody will experience the results of their karma, whether we know it or not. This is a natural law that's reasonable. You don't have to, the fact that you don't know botany doesn't mean the plants won't grow. Because you don't know that fire will burn you doesn't mean it won't burn you. So that's why we have to learn these natural laws. So if there is a person, and there are plenty of people on this planet who are seriously mentally ill, they can't do anything to change. So that's our job, to practice compassion and protect them. All animals are experiencing the fruit of their past actions. They can't change one millimetre. So this is the tragedy of karma. We set ourselves up with all this intense negativity. We then do negative things and we don't even realise. So this is the suffering of it all. So that's where compassion comes in. We protect other people from harming themselves and others. That's why you protect your cat from eating the mouse. You protect your crazy husband from abusing people. We do what we can to help others. But even ordinary mental illness, look how pathetic we are. Look how hopeless we are. Look how we can't even change our habit to eat too much cake. Can you imagine feeling like a pedophile? When we understand how pathetic, how deep attachment is just to control ourselves with cake, can you imagine the suffering of a pedophile's mind? Do you see what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
This is where compassion comes in, darling. Okay. So we talked a bit about purification. We mentioned a little bit about vows. We sort of touched on the main points about junior school, which is where we get the fundamentals of Buddha's teachings, the fundamentals of this law of karma that runs the universe. The law of karma is what governs the lives and minds of all sentient beings. There's no one made it up. No one's running it. It's just a natural law, like botany, like mathematics. It just works, you know. So we better learn it so we can control it. That's the whole point. So first level of practice, stop harming right now. Then if we connect with Buddhism, then we take refuge and take our five lay vows or our nun's vows. Then we can, you know, relate to the Buddha and connect with the Buddha and say prayers to the Buddha and remember the Buddha, and that puts imprints of the Buddha in our mind, which is excellent. And then we purify at the end of the day. That's a perfect practice. This will guarantee you'll have a happy death and get another decent human rebirth and meet the holy beings again and carry on practicing. It's logic. Karma's a natural law. It's logic. It's logic. Karma takes care, as Lama Yeshe said, you know. It's not hit and miss. It's not accidental. It's not punishment. It's not reward. All this fearful way we think about it. It's not like that. And the more we understand it's a natural law, the more we will want to be in control of it. We are the boss, you know. So then we get to high school where we really get to the root of the problem, which is the mind. When we begin to control the servants of our mind, our body and speech, which demands mental energy, it demands a lot of mental involvement. Your mind has to decide to control your hand, control the speech. It's your mind working, but it's mainly to control your body and speech. Now you use your mind to control your mind. This is where we get to where we become a Buddhist. This is where we become a Buddhist. That means we have to know the Buddhist model of the mind. We have to study it. You know, you guys in this country, in this town, have perfect opportunity with all these basic program and master's programs going on. We can study Lohrig. You can study the mind. That's the nuts and bolts of it. It's amazing. And this is coming from these amazing Hindus too. This incredibly sophisticated system that explains in great detail how the mind functions and then the contents of the mind. It's incredible, so sophisticated. But still, even still, as Buddhists, it's very curious. We still kind of think it as some secondary thing over there. And then we still talk like Westerners. We still talk like, oh, I've got problems and I've got issues and I've got the boyfriend this and the blah, that, I've got all these problems. And she was abused by her mother, she was abused by her sister. That's how the West talks. We're still addicted to the outside world. We're still addicted to this idea that we're some innocent victim. We've got all the Buddha's view there. It's all there for us, you know. But actually, it's quite shocking. Buddha's view is really quite radical. It's really hard to hear it. Because Buddha, if you look at the mind, when Buddha describes the contents of the mind, if you studied Lohrig, you know this. It's a detailed, fascinating, sophisticated, in-depth presentation. First of the epistemological model, the way the mind works. It's so sophisticated, so outrageous. And we're not discussing the brain here. We're discussing the cognitive process itself. And then the contents of the mind. But there's no mention of what your mother did to you. There's no mention of your brain, your DNA, your genes, your this, your chemicals. There's no mention of what your father, your grandfather and the monkeys did. That's the stuff of our culture. I'm not criticizing that view. Please don't hear. I mean, I sound like a fanatic perhaps. I'm not trying to. I'm trying to get as clear. This is Buddhist class. You can study neuroscience, please. Nothing wrong. Then you can have conversations like His Holiness has. But we've got to understand the Buddhist one first. We sort of see it as separate. You learn about attachment, you learn about this. Oh, then we have real problems over here. They're called issues, and they're called boyfriend problems, and they're called mummy problems and daddy problems. No! We've got to start looking at the mind. That's why we've got to have concentration. We've got to start practicing knowing how to listen to our thoughts. This is the job of being a Buddhist. It's radical because, of course, you've got to recognize something's happening out there. I've got to recognize Ron's got a problem in our relationship. But he's not my problem. He's his own problem. I'm my problem. This is very heavy to hear. This is very hard for us. Because why? Because we're addicted to believing the outside is the problem. Because that's all I can see and hear all day. I hardly even can hear my own thoughts. This is where Zamazopa says, it sounds very shocking to say this. The vast majority of all humans on this planet have absolutely no idea that what goes on in their mind plays any role at all in their lives. So Buddha's, you know, it's shocking what he's saying, actually. It's radical, psychologically, and not comfortable. So right now, I've just finished editing. Rinpoche asked me to put together all the letters that he's written to prisoners. Since the Prison Project started, and certainly in America, in 1995 we started it, and then we had a newsletter, then people would write to Rinpoche, ask him to be their guru and things like this. So, you know, Holly sent me like 100 letters of Rinpoche's over the last 20 years, people who've written to Rinpoche. And he's incredible how he writes letters. Holly told me one time when we did another book of Rinpoche's, he's got a folder at any given time of at least 2,000 letters from people all over the world. A friend of mine who had brain cancer wrote to him. She got an answer 2 years later, but it was the timing was perfect. Somehow it works, you know, I don't know. So these prisoners, one prisoner got a letter of 45 type pages. Rinpoche is like wrote a novel for this prisoner, and he's never anxious about the other 1,900 letters. He's incredible. If a person needs it, he will spend hours and hours and hours on that letter. So the point is, in this information, in this letter, and talk about now, we could use this as our textbook here, I tell you. Because Rinpoche only teaches at the most dramatic level, when it comes to wisdom, he only talks about merely labelled and emptiness. And when it comes to compassion, he talks about the most extreme levels of bodhicitta and transforming problems and all of that, you know. This book is unbelievable. But it's too much. It's like, it's what it is this book written, these American prisoners, mostly Americans, who wrote to him. And prisons in America are pretty intense, I tell you. Don't get me started. Unbelievable, you know. One of the most corrupt systems on the planet. Well, not the most corrupt. But the biggest numbers. I mean, the United States has 5% of the world population. It's got 25% of the prison population, meaning a quarter of all humans on the planet who live in prisons live in United States prisons. It's like this monster system. And it's getting worse. Mr. You know, who is bossing the country right now, it's just worse. It's unbelievable. Unbelievable system. Corrupt, unbelievable. Suffering, unbelievable. So for 25 years, I ran it for 15 years, and just all these letters we would receive, you know. And I mean, people who work in, like Venerable Tashi works in prisons. And you know, it's all the working class. It's all the poor people. I've never met a rich person on death row, I promise. When you have money, you can do anything. In every culture, it's the same. It's no different, isn't it? But it's the poor people. And America, that means the poor people, the black ones, the Latino ones. Unbelievable. The sentencing is like Victorian times. You know? Unbelievable. Unbelievable. I can't tell you. So the suffering is pretty intense. The physical environment. So there are all these prisoners in these garbage dumps treated like animals. No freedom, no money, no help, no family, nothing. This is what I found. They have nothing. Nothing. So what we mainly did in America when I was running it was I could see, because America is so vast and there's so many prisons, so many people, you couldn't visit every one. You'd go crazy, you know. So we started the system of writing letters to prisoners. And I know when I was running it, we were getting 1,000 letters a month from people in prisons in America, in Australia as well, but mostly in America. And so the best way to help was we gave them a person to write to, because most have nothing and nobody, no money, no friends. They're lost in this system. Lost, lost, they're lost, you know. Unless they're like so fortunate to find some kind of kind lawyers, and there are so many lawyers these days working for nothing, trying to help people, getting people off death row, getting people out of, you know, out of this terrible sentencing. But otherwise they're just lost and they go mad, you know, in these garbage dumps. It's really incredible. So these letters, you know, some of these guys are on death row. Some of them have got incredibly intense sentences. I mean, you know, in California, the first person who wrote to us was in 1996. This young Mexican, Arturo. He told me he wrote it less. And he'd read a book. He's in his cell 23 hours a day in one of these top security sections where many of the gangsters are, these Mexican gangsters. You know, it's their life. He told me he'd been in prison since he was in – he was in gang since he was 11 on the streets of Los Angeles, in prison since he was 12, and then tried as an adult when he was 16, and then now three life sentences. He's now out like a miracle because he found a lawyer and he practiced. He was incredible. Now he's out finally after 28 years, since he was 12 in prisons, you know. Now he's doing well. But it's a miracle. It's a miracle, I tell you. So he wrote and he said he'd read a book by Lama Yeshe. He's in his cell 23 hours a day and had this good library, like very fortunate. I don't know if your prisoners have good libraries, do they, Tashi? They have good libraries? Books? They don't have libraries. This is tragic. At least for some reason in California, they had good libraries. And this one guy who, you know, even I heard, they even told me they had television in their cells and they even saw some Buddhist movies. This librarian was very kind and managed to sneak in these Buddhist things, you know. And that's, these guys are on their cells. Huh? No books.
No, in Livorno, no book.
Really?
For example, in Milano, Bollate.
Yes, yes. Really?
I think I went there.
Some places are good. That's, but at least here, with these guys on death, and these environments where they're in their cell 23 hours a day, with they're allowed to have 10 books, no hardback, because you're in a cell with another guy in a very small cell, like a couple of meters, you know, in one cell all day, the most disgusting food you could ever imagine. No other right, and you're allowed 1 hour up and down walking in another cell. And they're like this for years and years, and most of them are the Mexican gangsters, ex-gangsters, you know. So this young man, he'd been in gang since he's 11, in this cell, you know, you go crazy if you haven't got an intelligent mind. And he read a book by Lama Yeshe. It was like a miracle, you know. And he was very moved by the talk about compassion. So he wrote to us. Mandela's address was in there. That's when I was editing Mandela. So he wrote a letter. And it grew from there, you know. We sent him a book. And it grew from there. Within 1 year, there were 40 people writing. It was all by word of mouth, you know. So I've not been into prisons. I mean, it was not part of my life. But it was a complete eye-opener. Unbelievable. The intensity, reading about these places, and the intensity of the suffering, the intensity of the sentencing, where this, you know, as ordinary people, you really have no hope. You really have no chance in an ordinary worldly way, unless some really good fortune comes, you know. So these guys, what I'm getting at is, there we are telling them all these Buddhist tools, like what we're hearing in this room. We can see how hard it is. But what's so interesting about these people in prison, and this is where we get to transforming problems practice, they somehow get it. Because we actually have the choice. If my relationship with Ron is really bad, technically I have the choice to leave. He's not holding me in. He's not locking me in, you know. We know that. But look at how hopeless we really are. We actually have the choice to leave that job, that relationship, if we can't handle it. But we're so overwhelmed by our own suffering, by our own sense of being a victim, that we don't even think I have the choice to leave Ron. I'll go back every day like a moth to a flame and then keep blaming him until one day he kills me or I kill him. But these guys in prison, they don't have the luxury of choice. They have no choice. They have, you know, the stories from the prisons. Like these guys who have cellmates, you know, and some of these guys are like psychotic. They're completely crazy. And the ones who are practicing Buddhism in their cell, they have a roommate who hates Buddhism and will do terrible things to them. They're so intense, the amount of obstacles they have, you know. But these guys, we send them these things about transforming problems. Lama Zopa writes these unbelievably intense advice to them. They eat it up. They're unbelievable, I tell you. I feel so kind of moved by this. Look how hard it is for us to transform anything that's a problem. We can't even change our, we don't think I can leave Ron, so I keep going back and blaming him, and then I don't think I can change my mind. But these guys know they have no choice. They've got to change their minds. And they take this advice in the most powerful way and really practice. I mean, when you read this book of Lama Zopa's, I offered it to Wisdom, but it's too intense for Americans to read it. I mean, you know, especially with the system. This is a very interesting point. When it comes to transforming problems, what we're talking about is taking serious external problems like political injustice and being harmed and in bad relationships and abusive relationships, which is really true. It's very heavy. But this advice from Buddha at this level is to learn to see it as good. This is like insanity. Normal people wouldn't talk like this. Not possible. So when the suffering is so intense, like these prisons, this advice Rinpoche gives is unbelievable. Like, learn to love the police who've accused you. Learn to love the people who put you in prison. Learn to be happy you're in a cell. Learn to think, you know, be rejoicing. I mean, it's like mad talk. The world would, I mean, think you're crazy talking this way. So to be able to hear this advice. See, what's interesting? Let's go through the eight verses now. Now we're talking about it. Let's go through the eight verses. You got it in your book, I think, haven't you? You got it in your course notes. I'll have to find mine, my version. We're now jumping into the compassion wing. I don't know where they are. Eight verses. Oh, I don't know where it is. Have you got it in your, you got it in your course notes, right? No, it's in the course notes, the printed notes, these printed notes. I'm sure it's in there. Have a look. I think it's in there. Let's have a look. I think it's in there. So what? Show people the page, would you? You got it. Okay. So I've got to find my copy in English. No, I know it roughly. Okay, I know it roughly. So let's try and get a sense of what Tibet would have been when it was written. Even Tibet in 1959 was like a holy place. You might have met a murderer once in 20 years. You might have heard about some naughty person, you know. I mean, it was just a very mostly Buddhist country. I'm not trying to say they were saints. But if you compare that, even in 1959, with our world, the intensity of violence, the intensity of terrorism and psychosis and crazies and pedophiles and murderers and gunmen. And we learn about it every day. We are bombarded by the most intense negativity and violence. It's true, isn't it? Try and imagine. So back then when Langri Tangpa wrote this text, it must have been like a Pure Land, you know? Think about it. So in these verses, in one of the verses, I think it's the I wish I had the text in English. I'll find it. But one of the verses, Siddhartha can find it for me, it says where, you know, when you meet people of evil, the one of evil, like the third verse, who are rare, the rare person who is really suffering from a lot of evil. In other words, when you hear about a psychopath, as we would call in our culture. Oh, thank you. So we'll go through it. Oh, yeah, verse 4. Whenever I see beings who are wicked, I mean, who says wicked these days? It sounds like a Broadway play. Psychopaths. Think of the word we use, a psychopath, like a maniac, a terrorist, a multi-murderer, crazy people. But here it says, who are wicked in nature and overwhelmed by violent negative actions and suffering. We get that. I can't imagine this person back in Tibet, you know, how naughty they must have been in the 11th century. I will hold such rare ones. That's how it would have been then. Such rare ones. Meaning very few. Even in 59, 90% of Tibetans were Buddhist. 99%. I'm not saying they were all saints. But in general, it was a very ethical country. They didn't kill worms, for God's sake. Not to mention each other. So can you imagine this one back then written in the, what was this, 11th century or something? And then now you transpose that into now, where we're living in these hell realms of insanity and of really suffering people and people doing the most monstrous harm to each other with all these sophisticated weapons we've created. This is serious transforming problems. So prisons in America are like these nightmare environments, nightmare. And the injustice is unbelievable. So to hear Lama Zopa say, to love your enemies, and it's like too much to bear. There's no way we can handle it in our culture. But these guys who want Buddhism, they get this advice from Rinpoche and they eat it up. They're able to practice it. It's so incredible, you know, because the injustice is so shocking. Of course, when you have the view of karma, you know why it's happening. So I remember I said, this is now gossip, I said to Wisdom, I said, we're happy with Lojong teachings. We're happy with these transforming problem teachings when they're in verse form and they're from the 10th century. But as soon as we have modern 21st century experiences of it, violence in prisons and injustice, you know, it's too hard to bear. It's too hard to hear. Are you understanding my point here? I hope so. Let's go through these verses and you'll kind of see my point. I can't stand reading these verses. It freaks me out, I tell you. It's so intense if we take it seriously. And this is where we've got to have an understanding. We've got to have some framework, like we've just been talking a little bit about understanding karma, understanding our mind, a little bit. This is the basis for understanding how to do this. And most of us, like I said, most of us still continue to blame the person who criticizes our next-door neighbor, our husband, our Buddhist colleagues. We're still sitting in the victim mode. We're still not even gone very far in our practice. We still believe it's not fair. People sacked me. They fired me. How dare they do this? I didn't do anything wrong. We have all the teachings. We have all the analysis. We have all the explanation. But it's very hard to take it on board. It's very hard to practice it. So the very first verse already is outrageous. Okay? This is where now I said before about reliance, a strange way about putting compassion, relying upon sentient beings. Here it says it, determined to obtain the greatest possible benefit from all sentient beings. Not for, from. Meaning, there I am wanting to be the best doctor on the planet. I want to help others. I've got to be qualified to help others. So I've got to have the have the most intense experiences so I can really test myself to become the best doctor. So then in order to get the benefit from all these suffering people in this tent in the war zone, who need new legs and this and that, the most intense suffering, in order to obtain the greatest possible benefit from all these suffering sentient beings, who are more, this is crazy, this is demented, this is ridiculous. They've got to analyze this. Who are more precious to me than a wish-fulfilling jewel. Well, forget boring old wish-fulfilling jewels. Just say €1 million. It's good enough. Can you try and imagine, this man who wrote this has to be serious. He's obviously experiencing this. He says, these sentient beings, all of them, are more precious to me than €1 million. So what the hell is this man talking about? He doesn't say it with a nice, pretty, a pleasant kind of poetic tone. What is he talking about? What do you mean they're more precious to me than €1 million? We've got to understand this. It's ridiculous words. It's ridiculous. And each verse gets worse. Why are they more precious? This is how bodhisattvas think. So what we can do is do our best. Why all these suffering sentient beings are so precious to you is because you are here trying to become a Buddha. What is a Buddha? A Buddha's like the best doctor. And you can't bear the pain of all these suffering sentient beings because you can't, and so you are desperate to become the best doctor because then you're qualified. Then you're qualified to help. So already this has got this incredible sense of urgency. And this is to enable you to become the best doctor as quickly as possible. Well, to become the best doctor as quickly as possible, like I said, you don't just dispense a few Band-Aids. You're gonna get the worst situation of the worst suffering. And you're going to see the intensity of all these suffering sentient beings who are more precious to you than €1 million, because with this opportunity, you can become the best doctor most quickly. This is logical. It's logical. So this is that incredible level of the wishing to help sentient beings, to use sentient beings as much as you can to help them in order for you to become a Buddha as quickly as possible. Who has got that kind of energy? None of us. It makes us tired to even think about it. More precious than €1 million? It just sounds like a demented idea. Think about it. We love to say these nice words in a, sweet way. They're mad. So we've got to at least understand it logically and then aspire to be like it. Next verse. Worse. Like I said, when you're with others, see yourself as the lowest of all. And then see others as supreme. So again, let's analyze the meaning of this. And this is where, if I'm still in this situation with Ron and I'm a victim, I'm hopeless, I have all this attachment, all this neediness, all this expectation that it's his job to make me happy, that I'm nobody, I'm nothing, I dump all my projections onto him. All this neediness, all this emotional hunger, normal person, normal world, normal person. And he becomes abusive. He becomes abusive. Normal relationship, nothing special. For me to hear this second verse is like mad. I think the person's insane if I read that. I will say to them, excuse me, mate, I already see myself as the lowest of all. What do you want to do? Rub my nose in it? So we have to understand the logic of these verses. And we have to know if we're capable of doing it. And if not, you aspire. Be intelligent. Know what you're capable of. This is too much for ordinary people, even for most of us. Buddhists as well. This is too much. This is intense. This is powerful meaning. So in other words, the only person who is capable of understanding this properly and of seeing yourself as the lowest of all and others as supreme is virtually as if you've got bodhicitta already, I swear to you. It means you've done so much work on your mind already. You understand karma, you understand your suffering, you know why you're suffering, you're sick of suffering, and now you look at your mind, you see the delusions, you're sick of them, and you've got renunciation. And now you really know why you're suffering. And now you get to the level of trying to practice compassion to benefit sentient beings, and you want to smash these unhappy states of mind. You want to smash ego and the voices of ego as quickly as possible because they are what are preventing you from becoming a Buddha. It's that level of intensity, you know. That's rare. So at least we have to understand it logically a little bit, where it's coming from. And then we can aspire because we have this potential. But we've got to know where we're at. So if I'm in a relationship with Ron and I'm the victim, and then I read this and I mistakenly misunderstand it. Oh, I've got to allow him to beat me every day. I've got to think he's fantastic. And I just end up becoming insane. I am crazy. I've got to learn to leave the man. I've got to learn to say, I'm out of here, baby. That's the very first level of practice. This is way too advanced. Ridiculous. But if you're capable, that's different. I always quote my mother's friend. She was a Catholic. My mum was a Catholic. And her friend Sheila, who was like a hilariously funny woman. I loved her. I'd go to visit often. She was my mum's best friend. Because her husband and my dad were both drank beer together and bet all their money on the horses and everything together. And they were good friends, right? So my mother and Sheila were like these friends. And Sheila was hilariously funny. She just lived on bread and butter and smoked about 80 Marlboros a day, you know. She loved God. She was amazing, incredible faith in God. And she was very funny. She had a sense of humor. Her husband was this ridiculous bloke who would abuse her. For her, it was like water off a duck's back. She believed God was in everybody. She loved her ridiculous husband. She didn't care what he did. It was nothing to her. And you knew it was nothing to her. She wasn't pretending. She wasn't a victim, in other words. So she was doing it her way during this ability. She really saw that God was in Reg. She didn't care what this crazy guy did to her. She didn't matter because she loved God. She was incredible. It was a very wonderful example for me. Of course, we don't believe that in our culture. We think she was suppressing, you know. No, not at all. She didn't suffer at all. She wasn't suffering even a bit. But you've got to be like that. You've got to know you're capable. A friend of mine has an alcoholic husband. She's a Buddhist. Years ago, she made a decision. She made a decision. This is what I'm getting to now. You know, if we're trying to really stop being victims before we get anywhere near to this level, you've got to decide what you can do. You've got to decide what you're capable of. So when it comes down to it, as brutal as it sounds, whether it's the job, your relationship with your sister, the relationship with your husband, you've got two options. Leave or stay. And if you stay, you work on your mind. We can do neither. We're so hopeless. We're just leaving it. I'm a victim. I'm blaming Ron for my problems. And someone says, you should leave him. Oh, no, I can't leave him. Oh, no, he really does love me. I know he loves me, really. I go home, whack again, you know. Oh, he still really loves me. And then one day I kill him. That's not intelligence. That's not practice. So the only person who's capable of thinking they're the lowest of all and seeing others as supreme was a person who's got incredible self-respect, who's got renunciation, who understands suffering, who understands karma, who understands attachment, who understands their own mind and is brave enough and powerful enough to be able to see the suffering of the other person, the abuser, and have it be not affecting them. That's exactly this. And this is a profound attitude. This is high. This is a brave, amazing attitude. And why? What's the basis of every bit of advice in these verses? Every one of the things in these verses is to do whatever you can to smash ego grasping and attachment. Why? Because they are what are preventing you from becoming a Buddha. So this is a radical level of practice. It's radical, I tell you. So we can think about it. We can aspire to it. We can try it once a year, maybe. But understand it logically. Where it fits in the teachings is so important, I tell you. To see yourself as the lowest of all. I mean, it's talking about all, you know? when in the company of others, I'll always consider myself the lowest of all. This is hard to hear, but we've got to hear it properly. And if we're not capable, then don't do it. You can't pretend. You can aspire by reading this and aspiring to become like this. Are we communicating here? So if I'm in this victim relationship, this is not my practice. My practice is to get the hell out of here and say, okay, Ron, bye, dear, I'm leaving. Don't blame him. But now I've taken control of my life. That's powerful practice. But mostly we can't even do that because we're so feeling like a victim. You've got a job you hate. You can't bear the boss. You can't bear your colleagues. And then you moan and complain. You complain every day, but you keep going back to the job. Well, you know, you could leave, Rabina. No, not possible. I couldn't get another job. Oh, no, I couldn't do that. No, I'd never have any money. Oh, no, I couldn't, blah, 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 blah. So you keep, but, well, you can change your mind. No, I can't do that. Can't change my mind. So we stay miserable, stuck in misery. Don't know we can change and can't change our mind. That's the nightmare. That's the victim mind. That's samsara. These guys don't have the choice. They're living with insane people. They're seen as like animals. They can't get out of these prisons. There's no way out for many of them. So what choice do they have? And I always quote this one example. I always quote this woman. I read a memoir, just a little bit about her memoir. She's an American, back in the 70s, this hippie, white woman, hitching in Florida with a hippie husband and hippie kids. And they get picked up by two guys, and then the guys stopped by the police, and the guys kill the police and blame the hippies. So they're on death row in Florida. They're the worst kind of criminal because, as far as their people are concerned, they killed policemen, so they're evil. And they're on death row. She gives her three children to her parents. They're safe, and then the parents get killed in a car accident. So she loses the kids as well. Like, you can't imagine the nightmare, you know. Husband gets executed. You can't imagine the nightmare. One thing after another, and you're completely innocent. I don't think she was a Buddhist. I think she did yoga and things. But she must have been very intelligent. I could call it that. She said at some point, finally, I realized I couldn't change anything. But they couldn't take my mind from me. So I decided I'm not a prisoner, I'm a monk. I'm not in a cell, I'm in a cave. I mean, it's like straight, absolute essence of what Buddha's saying. It's like the perfect example of the most simple and the most advanced level of Buddhist practice. Exactly as Buddha says. Buddha says you can change your mind. What Buddha's saying is really very simple. You can change your mind. But look how hard it is. And she was able to do this. Unbelievable. I mean, so mind-blowing. That quote blew my mind, you know. Now I've heard about since. She went to Ireland. She got out eventually. And then she went to Ireland and she went to some Amnesty International conference and then met some Irish fellow who'd also been accused of murdering two policemen during all the troubles in Ireland, you know. And then he eventually got out as well. And now they live in Cork in Ireland. They run a retreat centre helping people who've been wrongly accused of crime, especially from America, where it's so common, you know. Such an amazing human being. So this, I mean, this is such an example. I remember reading at the same time, I always quote this story, at the same time I read about some fellow on death row, also innocent, but who we would call normal. He went completely crazy, lost his mind, raging, screaming daily. I did not rape and kill that woman. I did not rape and kill that woman. In other words, he had unbelievable anger, rage, despair, mental illness until he went mad. So the normal way we see, and like I think, you know, we think, well, that's natural. And it is natural. It's normal to be this way when suffering is so intense. But all Buddha's saying is, you know, all he's saying, he has found that we have the capability to change the way we interpret things. That's the meaning of what Buddha's saying from the beginning to the end, and especially transforming problems. We can change the interpretation that we have of our life, and that is what will make us happy. And that's exactly what that woman did. And this is exactly the whole approach of transforming problems. So to really also realize this, you've got to have some understanding of emptiness, I swear. This woman, I didn't read enough about her, but I know that she did some yoga. But she must have had unbelievable, I think, emotional intelligence, that somehow she could see that she could change her mind. She could see that. She realised there was no benefit in bashing her head against a brick wall. This other guy, which is normal, he did that. And in fact, I've read about many people. And the really interesting point about the people who've been able to do this, and even the people who help people in prison, there's a movie just coming out now. I've read about it in the American papers, Get Mercy or something, and it's a story of an amazing black lawyer in Mississippi who specifically works getting people who've been wrongly accused off death row. And it's something like he's sort of already managed to get like 130 people off death row. And this movie's about one of these examples, a typical one of a black guy wrongly accused, and he managed to get him off. So the suffering, from that point of view, the suffering is unbelievable, so intense, you know. But this lawyer, he's a sweet man, never angry. And I think this is the key thing, that, you know, when we see in the world so much craziness, we give it all these names in the West. We give it psychosis and crazy and this and that and terrorism. But basically it's anger. Think about it. It's very simple. Anger. It's called anger. Don't make it complicated. It's called anger. It's almost like a revelation to keep it so simple. It's called anger. And what's anger? Anger is the response when attachment doesn't get what it wants. So this woman mustn't have had much anger. Her attachment did not get what it wanted, I promise. Her husband was executed, wrongly accused of murder, lost her children. Her parents died. She took 17 years living in hell. But she was able to see she could change her mind, and that's because she didn't have anger. This is a miracle, actually. We just think anger is like this normal, funny thing. It's a profound mental suffering, and it's the source of all the pain. Comes from attachment, of course. But this man, this lawyer, no anger whatsoever. So think of it, if he'd been angry, this is what I'm saying back there about your mum. Where are you? Your mum. If he has lots of attachment and then lots of anger, many people look after their mum, but they go crazy and want to hit her and get angry and get upset and then get guilty, because anger is so powerful. But if you don't have anger, you're like, I'm thinking, it's like a miracle not to have anger. It's like a miracle not to have anger. And when you don't have anger, like that poor guy, he went out of his brain. He had anger, rage, despair, understandable. She didn't. They're both innocent. They're both innocent. I guarantee he must be still in prison. But this is the interesting point. Because she didn't lose the plot, she didn't have much anger, she was able to change her mind, then she kept her sanity. So she was able to continue to work on her freedom, and she eventually got out. But if you go crazy and lose your mind and you can't do anything, you will even get worse suffering, you know. So anger is actually so simple, but it's so profound. It is this source. Why do you think people harm each other? Of course, attachment is one basis, but it's anger. Anger is the worst, worst possible. And we can see it in the way the world is so intense now, the suffering is unbelievable, unbelievable, unbelievable. And then you lose your brain. You lose your mind. You've gone mad. You've lost it. Once you get angry, you're finished. And that's our natural response to when things go wrong. I remember one of my friends, a Tibetan, Jigdrol, a Kopan monk, and he, years ago now, he was involved in the first kind of mini uprising in Tibet in 87, like a big, fairly big uprising since 59, and all the young monks and nuns who were the radicals, you know, demonstrating. So he was telling me the story. We can have a break soon. In a minute. Have a tea break or something. So he was telling me this suffering, you know. He was one of the radicals. He was demonstrating. He got arrested. He got tortured in prison. They then released him. Then he demonstrated again. Then his friend had his head blown off, and then he thought he'd better leave, you know. So he went to Nepal. And then since he left, his father got murdered, brother got murdered, and he was telling me the story. And it was kind of sad. There were tears, you know. And I said to him very casually, I said, Jigdrol, do you ever get angry? And he laughed casually and said, Peter, what do you mean angry? It's our fault. Now, those words are very shocking, aren't they? It's our fault. But he's just talking casually about karma. When you have the view of karma, when you really do have the view of karma, not just intellectual, when it's genuinely the view you have in your bones that informs the way you interpret your life, you would not have anger. Let's analyze this. It's very fascinating. This is looking at attachment and anger at a deeper level. at a more primordial level, at the level of deep, deep assumptions. So attachment, the main voice of ego grasping, is this profound assumption that I must get what I want every millisecond. That's the real voice of attachment. It's like so brutal to hear it like this. It's frantic. It's fear-based. Fear is the nature of all the disturbing emotions. People often say, where's fear? If you look in low rig, you won't find fear listed. Why? Because all the disturbing emotions are rooted in fear. Fear is their nature. And that's why Islam, yes, he says, when you realize emptiness, there is no fear. This is very shocking to hear. So, What was I saying? I forget. I lost the plot again. What was I saying? Fear, yeah, sure, fear. Low rig, I said that, I know. What was I talking about before that? What was the sentence before that? Huh? What? Anger, okay, anger, wait, anger. Yeah, I know, now I've lost it. What was it? God, sorry. Now I've all gone. As soon as you try to get it, it's gone. I was about to say something. Talk about anger, attachment, fear. What was I saying? Please tell me, somebody. Oh. What? Anybody remember? What'd you write down? Oh, yeah. Was that it? Oh, yeah, Jindrol. Thank you. Yes. Yes, 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 yes. Analyzing attachment. Yes, yes, yes. Okay, thank you very much. I need to get some concentration. Okay. Let's look at the deep, the most primordial level of attachment and aversion, which are the root of all our suffering in day-to-day life, upon which the other delusions are all grown, you know, coming from, expressed. Okay. So at the deepest, most primordial level, attachment is this instinctive, panic-stricken assumption, frantic assumption that I just got to get what I want every second. This is what drives us. And remember, another way of putting it is, attachment only wants the nice things. It can't cope with problems. It can't stand. In other words, attachment can't stand getting what I don't want. It's utterly self-centered, if we understand it properly. So at this primordial level, it's an assumption. And another way to put that, it's an assumption that I deserve only the good things. It's very deep inside, very deep. It's an assumption that I deserve only the good things. I deserve. Now, we're going to analyze this meaning of deserve. It's very fascinating. Then when it doesn't get what it wants, aversion, anger, outrage, despair, you name it, whatever it is on the spectrum of aversion, it's an outrage, especially very strong anger, is this outrage. And you listen to the philosophy of anger. When that thing, like that poor man, that poor suffering man, when something bad happens to us and we didn't do anything immediately to cause it because it's past karma, then the first thing, especially, the more, let's say I'm being nice to Ron, I'm a kind little good wife, and he's mean to me, he abuses me, he harms me, then if anger arises in the mind, what anger is saying, this is the philosophy of anger, how dare you do that to me? I don't deserve it. Isn't it? That's anger, isn't it? That's what it's saying. It's the outrage. And when it feels so right and correct to have that, especially if I didn't do anything to Ron. This is very natural. And this is the philosophy, this is the Buddha's view. This is what samsaric philosophy is. And he says, and especially in our modern world, this is the view we believe is the truth. Think about it. It's very fascinating. So we think anger is a really good quality. When you've been harmed. So it's good having compassion to help people who've been wrongly accused. That's incredible. That's called compassion. But attachment and anger, being these assumptions, I deserve happiness and I don't deserve suffering, these are what drive our decisions. And it's all this assumption. In other words, it's this incredible, there's an English term, we have You can see it with some people who are very selfish. In other words, with lots of attachment. They have this sense, what they say is a sense of entitlement. You know that one? A sense of entitlement? I deserve happiness. It's sort of my right. It's my right. There's never a doubt. It's my right to get what I want. How dare you don't do what I want? That really, when we see very selfish people, we can see that. Well, that's what we've all got to some degree. That's attachment and aversion. And we don't question these assumptions. Now, but let's analyze the meaning of deserve. It's very fascinating. I mentioned it just briefly yesterday, but I'll go into more detail here. If you have a bank account or a garden, let's say the bank account, and you open the bank account and there's no euros there, you do not say, you don't get angry and say, how dare there be no euros? I deserve euros. Think about this for a second. What we mean is that the logic of deserve, it's an assumption that somehow there is someone out there who should be good to me, who should make me happy, who should put euros in my bank. That's what attachment's thinking. There's an assumption of an innocent victim who deserves happiness. That means other people should give it to me. Think about that. That's attachment. So arrogant. But you'd never say it. Your point is, you would never say it about your own bank account. The reason is very simple, because you know it's your bank account. You own your bank account, and you know that what's in there is what you put there or what you didn't put there. So you might be upset with yourself, but you would never say, I deserve euros. Why aren't there euros in my bank? Because you know it's your bank account. So that's why the one about the garden is a good analogy. You never look in your garden and say, how dare there be no flowers in my garden? I deserve flowers. And you're looking around wondering who's going to put flowers in your garden. Nobody says that, because it's your garden and you take responsibility for what's in it. That's the view of karma. That's what Diderot's response was. He knew his life was his life. He knew whatever he experienced was put there by him. They know that in their bones since they're born. That's their philosophical view of the universe. Like the materialist view is our philosophical view of the universe. We take it for granted. That's why we have so much anger and attachment. Because that's our philosophy, without question. That's our philosophy, deep in our bones. So Jigsaw didn't have that. So there he was being harmed and tortured. He must have been suffering, but he wasn't angry. This is very, very weird for our culture. We've got to really analyze it carefully. So anger is a sense of entitlement. Anger comes from the entitlement of I deserve happiness. And then when the bad thing happens, we are outraged. How dare they do that to me? So this is another example I always quote. Back in 2003, when I was working for the Prison Project in California, Richard Gere had invited Dalai Lama to New York. And so he had decided to decided to collaborate a bit on the prison thing, but he decided to do his own thing. So what he did was he invited 20 former prisoners, all Americans, Puerto Rican, black, white, you know, male, female, a group of people who'd all done some kind of meditation in prison, and he invited them all to come and have a meeting with His Holiness, and people like me were invited as well, who work with people in prison. It was a very moving day. It was very wonderful, you know. And they met His Holiness and they're all very blissful. And they're all talking about their suffering and all this, you know, the racism, the sexism, the blah, 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 the injustice, all this. And it's, you know, all that. So the thing was, he also invited two young Tibetan nuns, young women who'd been also imprisoned in Tibet and had been tortured and sexually abused for a couple of years into prison, right? So these young women were telling their experiences. And probably the Americans probably thought, you know, no question, that this women's suffering was probably more than everybody else's. It's pretty clear, if you can quantify suffering. But what was, I think, shocking to the Americans, to ordinary people, was, these young women weren't angry. That means they had the view of karma. Since they're born, that's the view they're brought up with. That's the view they take as a given. It's just in their bones, just like the materialist view is in the bones of our being. So there were tears. The suffering was quite intense, you know. But there was no anger. It was very clear. And then one of them said, and of course, We had compassion for our torturers because we knew we must have harmed them in the past and because we know they will suffer in the future. So this is why, that's the compassion that we're talking about in this level here. That's the compassion of the compassion wing. That's the compassion of the bodhisattva. And you cannot have that level until you have karma. That's why both of those different people, because having the view of karma, they understood and they were able. And so the karma is a basis to grow then this valid compassion for every sentient being, because every sentient being is coming from the suffering they've done in the past and they will suffer in the future. So it's like this insane asylum we all live in, each of us experiencing the fruits of our past actions and then going along and blaming everybody else and getting more suffering in the future, never ending. So when you have the view of karma, and it takes time, it's serious to really apply it seriously. Not just to learn it philosophically and be clever and pass your exam, you know, in the master's program. Got to internalize it. Apply it every second. And this is where our problem is. We're so intellectual. We're so intellectually brilliant in our culture. We can easily learn all this stuff. You can get top marks in the master's program and still not practice. It's very easy to do that. We're very good with intelligence. We're very good with the brain. It's easy to do that and not put this into practice. But we have to start somewhere. Start with the thoughts. Then to really apply it, you know, is the hardest part. And that's why in our own lives we can't avoid problems. We all know you don't have to ask problems to come. 1,000 times a day your attachment won't get what it wants. So 1,000 times a day when the baby attachments don't get the baby wants, like the wrong noise and the wrong sound and the husband being slightly mean, don't wait till he wants to kill you or cheats on you before you start working on your mind. It's too difficult. Don't wait till you're in prison, accused of wrong, of murdering somebody before you start working on your mind. Deal with the little things. Practice with the baby stuff first. Then we grow in our capacity. You know, this is the essence of being a Buddhist, actually. This level is, you know, until we really start to transform problems, it's almost like we're playing safe. You know, are we communicating here? Any questions, please, people? Any questions? Yeah.
Hello.
Hello there.
So my name is Linda, and the question is just about this precise example with the nuns.
Yes.
Because you said it was never ending.
Sorry.
You said precisely that it's never ending.
If we don't practice.
So that's what I'm thinking about. So the fact that the nuns feel compassion.
Yes.
That they're working on their mind.
Oh, yes.
So
that's exactly right, and they won't suffer in the future result, and they will eventually meet these crazies again. They will only have love and compassion for them, and they won't get they won't get harmed, and they won't want to harm them. Absolutely. Yes. That's the point. It's never ending if we don't practice. That's the point. Otherwise, why practice if it keeps never being ending? Why just give up, you know? Die now. Don't bother. Absolutely. But the one to really look at is how, you know, this attachment and aversion, they're so simple words. They're such simple words, you know. And we've got to understand them at the very first level, the most basic level, and then we've got to see it at more deep level, which is how they really dealt with in when we get to the transforming problems section, which we're here now. So this attachment and aversion are much more primordially deep than they seem initially, but we've got to start where we are. Start by controlling attachment to these sense objects first. But it gets way more subtle. That's why in these teachings at this level, we hear about this weird phrase called the 8 worldly dharmas, you know. All that is attachment presented in a more primordial, fundamental way. 4 different pairs, 4 ways of looking at how primordial attachment is. How it runs the universe, it runs our lives, you know. So there's more subtle levels, or it's a more primordial level of attachment. So as we know, these 8 worldly dharmas, and this comes in the 8th verse, actually, the 7th verse. And then we'll go through the verses. We'll continue the verses. Maybe it's time for tea. Time for a break. Have a break, okay? See you in half an hour. Okay? Thank you. Where's my key? Thank you, Juliana.